AI is going to have a huge impact on health and care. With innovations coming thick and fast, how do we move forwards as intelligently and quickly as we can? Well, the US is often ahead of the game. That's where investment, development, and use of AI in healthcare is most advanced. So what can we learn from stateside? With me in the studio to discuss all this, I am delighted to welcome Andrea Palm, who until January this year was President Biden's Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, where, among other things, she led the development of the federal strategy on AI in health and care. And Professor Andy Beinman, who is Executive Vice President and Chief Medical Officer at Kaiser Permanente, one of the US's largest integrated healthcare systems. Welcome both. Andrea and Andy, really nice to have you on the podcast. Let's just step back for a minute and think about artificial intelligence in health and healthcare. It's a very fast-moving scene. It's almost like trying to run in a fog, isn't it? The developments are coming thick and fast. Perhaps turning to Andrea to kick us off, I mean, clearly the Department of Health and Human Services needed a strategy. Can you say about how that came about and the ultimate shape of it to try to help the US progress further, faster?
The president, the White House, were very focused on the need to try to stay as close to caught up with the developments in AI as we could, that as a government, we didn't want to fall behind in our role of leadership and our role of oversight, making sure that it was used safely and responsibly across the whole suite of the government enterprise. At the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, my job was to help lead our effort to develop a strategic plan. One of the real privileges of being at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is the breadth and depth and scope of the place. It's an almost $1 trillion organization at the time, global footprint with over 80,000 employees, really cradle to grave in how you think about the health and well-being of the population that you serve. So all the human services, all the public health, the entire NIH research enterprise. We oversee the safety and effectiveness of all the medical products that get into the marketplace, not to mention the actual healthcare system, right? It was my role to think about the ways in which we could ensure public trust in the system, that we were on the front end enough to have governance in place that was really driving safe and effective and responsible use of AI products, but also that was setting a vision for the future. What do we want the healthcare system to look like? How do we take lessons we've learned over time from a very fragmented healthcare system and think about the way public health and population health need to be married better to the healthcare system, how human services, social determinants of need, disability programs, behavioral health, right? The American healthcare system, we still have just kind of bolted substance abuse and mental health services onto healthcare. How do we take this opportunity to fully integrate, to smooth those frictions, to reduce those silos? And so that's really how we tried to think about this strategy. How do we leverage all of the assets of the department to drive better health and well-being for the whole population?
I mean, if you stand back from the strategy, by the way, those of you listening, I really recommend you have a look at it because I thought it was a very intelligently written and comprehensive strategy. But Andrea, clearly, there would be conceptions about what the role of the state is, the government is in this. How did you conceive where the state should leave off and where guidance should just be there for others?
I think there's two things here. One, an assumption that the authorities that we currently had in statute were the right ones for this new generation of technology. In some places, that's probably true, and in other places, it's not. For example, our statutory framework for data privacy and security probably will, you know, match pretty well with how you think about what needs to happen for data security and privacy in AI. But on the flip side, we regulate medical products in a way that hasn't really caught up with generative AI. And so how do you think about what is the framework? Because you can't bring products to the market that aren't safe and effective. And AI brings a different meaning of what safe and effective is to the medical product space. I think you build the plane while you're flying it. You use the tools that you have, but you need to quickly decide which ones aren't adequate and then who should be responsible for them. The federal government and the HHS particularly, we oversee such a large portion of the economy and we have such an important role in ensuring that the American people get what they deserve and what they expect from their government that there's no way not to have some central theory of how they need to operate and then who needs to augment them.
Yeah. And so I'm hearing there's a few big areas where the state obviously has a role. Data security, for example, safety, I think are two big ones, aren't they? Mm-hmm. But then other things are left to health systems, professional bodies or whatever to fill in the gaps. And
often in the U.S., regulate by floor. These are the minimum standards. Yeah. And to comply with law, you meet those minimum standards. If you choose to go above that, then that's fine. But we set the ground rules and the guardrails, and then people can fill in and personalize in ways that make sense for their particular system. But you've got to have that floor if you really want people to trust what is happening in this space.
Andy, you obviously heard that you're operating within these guardrails, but then there's a lot of room for maneuver locally, I guess, particularly in Kaiser and other health systems like that. How have you approached this wild west of an AI system and all these new innovations bouncing into the system?
We have about 12.5 million members, and we are trying to think about the tremendous opportunity of tools like AI to improve the care experience, to improve our ability to identify risk in our population, to try to improve the quality of the experience, not only for our members, but also for our providers in terms of making their life easier. So we see great promise. But our number one approach to this, first of all, is how do we implement this in a responsible way? Just like any intervention we do in healthcare, do no harm, right? Making sure that we are both moving efficiently and effectively, but doing it in a safe and responsible way. So we do try to have a set of principles that guide the work that we're doing. We use a little acronym called PROTECT. The P is for privacy protections related to our members and making sure that we safeguard in accordance with laws, regulations, and ethical practices. The R of PROTECT is for reliable, that we develop and use AI tools that are consistently stable and secure, because one of the things that we've learned about these tools is that they don't always necessarily perform in the same way each time. They're very different than other kinds of tools in some way. The O stands for outcomes, because we're very outcome-driven in our work, and we're trying to really leverage AI specifically to improve our outcomes. The T is for transparent, so we try to ensure that our patients are informed and give their consent when it's appropriate. The E stands for equitable, because we're really mindful of how, as we try to harness AI to promote health, there's the risk of, as we've seen with other technologies, of widening disparities as opposed to addressing them. The C stands for customer focus, so we address the needs and outcomes that matter most to our members. And then the final T of PROTECT is trustworthy. We're trying to build trust in how we use these tools with our members and with our providers and so forth. And reflecting on some of the comments that Andrea made as well, we're also, as both a developer and a customer of these tools, are trying to think about how do we use them in ways that are responsible, but also that meet the goals of what we're trying to do for our organization. You know, you have said it's a little bit of a murky situation to try to navigate all the things that are going on there. In my role as the chief medical officer, I easily receive 50 unsolicited messages a week of different vendors saying, try this tool, it'll change, you know, the life of your members and so forth. And I have to really think about what is it that I'm trying to do on behalf of our members to improve their health and to make it work with our system. And I think we need to talk about the ecosystem and how well it is aligning with the workflow and how we do our care in a way that these tools are an adjunct and not taking our attention away from the most important things. You can get lost if you aren't really thoughtful about the North Star of what you're trying to do in this work. And that's why it was so incredibly helpful to have frameworks that really are trying to help us think about on a population level, what are we trying to do here? What can these tools really do to enhance our care delivery model and not distract us from, isn't this a really interesting card trick that these tools can do?
How do you decide your North Star? What process do you have at Kaiser?
The sphere of AI, of course, is not uniquely in the clinical space. It also involves things like supply chain or involves administrative tasks related to the organization, but particularly things that interface related to clinical care. We have a governance council that involves both clinicians as well as members from the health plan that we jointly review and evaluate tools. And we do this in part because, you know, we have about 25,000 physicians in our organization. And we are trying to be mindful of how do we move collectively together toward the tools that are going to be most helpful for our membership. Clinicians help us evaluate what they prioritize as important areas, but also bring the perspective of the plan and the population issues as well to mind. And so we evaluate together and make choices together. And then even when we've made a selection, we have a process of responsibly implementing where we're learning along the way together, getting input. So one of the big things that we implemented together, for example, was an AI scribe program. And in doing that, we work closely between the health plan and the clinicians about the possibility of this. We did a small pilot of it. We then expanded that pilot as we learned more together, got feedback from the clinicians about it, and ultimately scaled up over time and learned together and also made a contribution to the literature related to our experience so we could hopefully help others along the way. But it really is a partnership between the plan and our clinicians about what tools can be helpful. And I don't think it would work with just one side trying to drive it and the other side not involved, because when these tools are developed in isolation, as I was mentioning, they aren't mindful of the workflow and what the clinicians need to do and how they're going to use the information. It's so important to have that connection so that people understand, oh, we're going to discover more disease this way. We have to be prepared on the health system to respond to it. Or if we're going to create new workflows, how that's going to work. And I think that's the biggest challenge with a lot of vendors that are approaching us is that they have isolated tools that are not fitting into how the system actually needs to absorb them and think about making use of them on a population level.
And Kaiser is unusual in that it's a big operation. It's well respected. It's been going since 1945. There are lots of other hospitals in the US and medical groups that simply don't have the resources. So I'm just looking at Andrea, how does then the federal level learn from the big centers to help the smaller ones in the US? Was that part of your strategy?
It's got to be wired into all the ways in the US that you think about the health and well-being of people, because we always have small providers, rural frontier communities, Native American populations suffer huge health disparities in the US. And if you aren't conscientious in these efforts, you know, fill in the blank which one it is. This one is AI. But if you're not really conscious about how you make sure they don't get left behind, they get left behind. And so it's part of the reason why it was so critical that our strategy incorporate human services as well as public health, because they have historically gotten left behind in the technology revolutions. And I think when you have big systems like a Kaiser and others, our academic institutions, people are working really hard to be contributors to the response. Responsible development and deployment of AI and how you partner with them.
What we've had in this country is quite a lot of stuff poking through the national press where there's been an individual vendor who's making claims about a system, about the impact. And often the NHS is part of that claim because there hasn't been sufficient rigorous evaluation of it. Or there's some initial results with a small group of people and then suddenly it's all over the press. It's very difficult for them to adjudicate. So part of this issue, presumably, is to just get a proper system going of really bearing truth as to what's actually happening. And yet to do this in a fast way that our normal evaluative techniques don't do. You know, if you're waiting for an RCT, it's like 3 years, isn't it? Or 2 years, $2 million later. So I don't know whether your focus has been on really fast assessment that's good enough to keep you going until there's a more of a formative assessment for later. Can you say a bit more about that?
First of all, one of the risks here is if these tools are coming in through all the doors and windows of your organization, it's very hard to then keep track of it, to learn in a constructive way, and to make sure that you're achieving your goals related to equity and ways that you're systematically getting the benefits. So we have put a strong system of governance in place to evaluate which things we're doing. We create sandboxes, if you will, where people can experiment and try to think about things that they might develop from the front lines. But in terms of deploying them at scale, we really try to have a system in place of governance councils that ensure that we're not having these tools sort of just show up in different parts of our system and then we don't know what is going on. So we are trying to work collectively, and I think that's really an important part of what needs to be considered here. And then, yes, making a commitment to learning rapidly, and it's not always in the form of a randomized trial. Sometimes there are other ways that you can implement in a real-world way to try to learn both about the safety aspects but also what some of the benefits are. And again, one of the ways that we think it's important to contribute to the general knowledge around this is to be doing this evaluation and publishing on it so that not every organization has to reinvent the wheel and go through this evaluation. But I do think there are rapid ways to be able to kind of learn. And we stood that up, for example, with this AI Scribe. We've done similar things. In some cases, they are randomized trials. We've done a randomized trial, for example, of an alert monitor system that we developed that was to help us identify and risk stratify patients on our medical and surgical wards who might be at risk of decompensating and needing to use higher level care like an intensive care unit. And we did that as a randomized study to partly, again, bring along our own community of clinicians and others to say, is this going to be valuable? Yeah. Because everyone's like, well, of course I'm monitoring my patients. But in fact, we demonstrated that there was statistical benefit in terms of being able to reduce morbidity and mortality associated with using tools like this. So I do think it's really important, but part of it is to not get distracted on every possible one of these tools, but to really think about what value are they offering on a population health basis? What is the North Star for the outcomes that you're trying to pursue? And to make sure that, in fact, these tools are doing that at the same time that they're building trust with your patients, they're building trust with your clinicians and so forth. Yeah. So in some ways, we're trying to think a little bit about what are the things that have the most broad-based utility for us and really going at scale for those? So when we did the AI Scribe, we rolled it out to all 24, 25,000 physicians over a short period of time because we saw the value quickly with that, as opposed to spreading ourselves over many, many tools.
And I saw the New England Journal AI article. Correct. I think it was initially 5,000 clinicians that had rapidly assessed. Correct. Can I ask how rapid was that?
Oh, yeah. It was just a handful of months that we were able to do this. And we had a steering committee. We would meet weekly, a team of us in which we would rapidly gather the input related to what we were hearing back. We actually learned some interesting oddities about, you know, the tool. We were able to tweak that along the way.
So troubleshoot, adapt, iterate.
Correct.
And understand if there's sort of glaring safety issues.
Correct. Like a small thing that might come up, for example, if the patient was in the room with the clinician and then there was a family member and so forth. And so there were three people talking. The tool might initially sometimes be confused about that. And so we're able to work with the vendor and help to identify that. And it got much better over time in terms of being able to do it and also able to speak to our clinicians to give them certain hints about how they could help the tool to be more effective at being able to sort that out for the medical note writing.
So Kaiser is funding this by itself because it's part of its business. And if it's a private vendor that's giving you the AI thing that you are then adapting, does Kaiser get any monetized benefit from the fact that you are enhancing that product for 12 million people?
It's not developed that way. I will say that by, of course, being a large purchaser, you can think about anything that you can purchase that you're able to be more effective as a purchaser when you're buying it for 20,000 physicians than you are if you're going out and trying to buy it as a small practice, but, you know, by yourself. But that's been less of our focus. We really have been trying to think about which ones of these tools will lead to the benefits we're getting, which is more efficient workforce, a happier workforce, happier patients. Nice. One of the things that has been most striking to us around this Scribe tool is that as we've continued to try to recruit primary care physicians to our organization, what we're hearing is that these primary care physicians are saying they won't even consider anymore going to organizations that don't offer these kinds of tools because it's become something that now is seen as really fundamental to making it possible to do the work of primary care.
I think that the Scribe technology is the perfect example for governance. It's critical at the health system level that that exists. It's critical at the federal level that that exists. But I think it also speaks to the way in which we're going to have to change our thinking about oversight, because this is a classic example of something that would never fall under federal oversight. It's not a medical device. Nobody is at the federal level, at the HHS, is going to be thinking about its appropriate deployment to minimize whatever risk there might be, right? It is a low-risk application, but it is a perfect example, and there will be thousands of them, of things that fall outside of traditional healthcare governance from a regulatory and oversight perspective. And what is it going to provoke us to think about to make sure that there aren't inadvertent consequences? And again, not everything should be regulated. I am not suggesting that at all. But this is a generation of technology in which we are going to need to rethink its interaction with the healthcare system, considering how high consequence it is for people's health and well-being. And again, the low-risk stuff is not what I'm worried about, but this is something that is going to get deployed rapidly in the system and that nobody is going to be thinking about unless you have governance at the health system level that is well-developed and is good at it, which again brings back to these small providers who aren't going to have the expertise and the capacity. And so how do we make sure that low-risk, unregulated tools are dispersed in a way that they are vetted? And who are those partners? And how, right? It's a whole different piece of oversight that is going to be really critical. And the government should have a role in helping to figure that out. Governance is foundational to all of this.
And just going to public health, what excites you about the possibility of AI in population health activities or indeed prevention?
Public health is under-resourced around the globe. Mm-hmm. And it is a place where the U.S. government, particularly CDC, have been a leader in capacity building in everything from Ebola outbreaks to trying to eradicate polio. And so this is a place where I think the U.S. government should absolutely continue to lead. People are very interested in the shiny object of predictive analytics and chasing the next outbreak. And that is very cool and really important. But I think foundationally, we as a population still don't have our arms around the biggest drivers of healthcare costs and illness in our country. You know, everything from diabetes to cancers to all of the things that a population health model could really help move the needle on. Not only is this an opportunity for population health, it's an opportunity for public health and for its reintegration into the healthcare system in a way that really could just so dramatically improve the health of the public.
We put some of this in place at Kaiser Permanente. One of our developed tools is a predictive model with AI that we use to identify members who have a high level of social need. So we use different kinds of indicators in our data. I'll just give you at a high level, maybe an individual who's missed multiple appointments to their GP and seeing that as, oh, I wonder, is that an indication of someone who's got a challenge with transportation or is having a challenge of balancing the financial needs that they have related to housing and food with what they need for medication and so forth. And then we connect that with our clinical teams to also then address social health issues so that we can, in fact, try to improve health outcomes for our population as a whole. So I do think exactly what you're saying, Andrea, in terms of connecting public health strategies and with our clinical care and ultimately for the benefit of our patients to improve their outcomes. And I do think these tools, when thought of in that way, in an intentional way of what they can do on a population health basis. Unfortunately, I think the marketplace has been largely focused on things that might be purely about generating revenue or driving a certain kind of utilization pattern. And so while many of the tools are adaptable and helpful, we're also finding places that we need to develop tools that meet the needs of our system and trying to be value-based in our orientation.
How far is Kaiser going upstream into primary prevention, given all the tools that are likely to come about on personalized risk prediction, how far are you going to get into risk mitigation, particularly for people perhaps, I don't know, age 60 plus?
I mean, this is so fundamental to our integrated model and how we think about population health, which is to, as you say, move upstream and try to prevent health problems when it's more possible to do that at an earlier stage. It's often less expensive to do so. But you can't just be screening and then finding all sorts of things that you go like, oh, that's a shame, because you have to have interventions that can actually make a difference. So we are really mindful of contributing to the evidence around that, as we have through our work over the years of looking at the value of screening for cancers of different types and so forth. So we're really intrigued with some of the power of the tools of precision medicine and are doing quite a bit of work to expand the implementation of precision medicine tools to help us move upstream in the way that you're talking about. But we're evaluating all those things along the way as well, and what our capacity as a system, because you can't, if you just discover all these things, suddenly you inundate your system and you have challenges being able to do that. So it's a fine balance between finding things earlier and having the capacity to be able to attend to them. But I do think ultimately, yes, we are looking at a future where we have a greater ability for our patients in partnership with our clinicians to learn more about the health risks and to hopefully, you know, attend to them at an earlier, less costly stage.
And Andrea, you mentioned earlier something called human services, which we don't use that term here. But what I think you mean, or at least what I read in the strategy, were interesting potential use cases of AI by communities that are trying to help build assets locally in health. And we've got this discussion at the moment because clearly public funds are quite limited. There are lots of left behind neighborhoods. There's a lot of assets in those neighborhoods that are currently unused. And I wondered if you might just expand on that for us.
When we talk about human services, we should be talking about it from an asset model. Oftentimes in the U.S., we talk about it, sadly, from a deficit model. And so we talk about poverty. We talk about things like substance abuse as things that we need to tackle in communities. And so I think because human services is also very underfunded, again, there's an opportunity here to think from an asset perspective how we utilize this next generation of technology to really bring to bear opportunities for folks who are in these circumstances to level up. In the child welfare system, for example, caseworkers with huge caseloads, kids who need more attention than can be provided by a really overworked system. How do we think about these tools making the jobs of caseworkers easier, of getting ahead of risks, of helping families cope better with circumstances in ways that we don't lose years of a kid's life, right? That years in a kid's life is a lot of their life, and we owe it to them to do it better. It is the most important role of a federal government to lift up, to look ahead, to leverage all of what we have to deliver better. And we cannot leave this particular population behind. They need work supports. They need housing supports, maybe food assistance, right? Things where the cracks really showed in COVID. Mm-hmm. We should not let that happen again. And this is an opportunity to lift all boats. And it's our responsibility as a government to serve the people that our legislatures have tasked us to serve. And we can do it better, and we should do it better. And this is a real opportunity.
Andy, we spoke earlier before this podcast about the critical infrastructure of data on which AI platforms are built. There's no point having the flashy stuff until the basics are done. Kaiser is well known. I think you were the first to have the Epic system in the US. I think it was $6 billion. I think it was a massive investment that everyone was making, which for US standards, it was massive. We have something called the Data Maturity and Quality Index. We do assess quality in the data of the NHS. We have one system, and it's patchy, but it's improving over time. In today's cutthroat, fast-moving world, where any extra money is just looked at, frowned upon, because people don't have it, how do you build investment for the long term here? How do you decide how much to put into the capital versus the immediate flashy stuff?
So we have a budget and we have a defined population, very similar to the NHS. And that gives us a certain degree of flexibility to try to think a little bit about how to spend our resource. And to your earlier comment, our organization was one of the very first adopters of electronic health records because it was seen that this could be a powerful way to support population health. And so we weren't on that hamster wheel, if you will, of having to charge fee-for-service and be stuck in that system. So we were able to make specific decisions around investments in IT, and they have paid off tremendously. I mean, I think Kaiser Permanente is known throughout the United States as having, you know, among the very best quality because all of our clinicians are working off the same, you know, medical record. And we speak a lot about like, oh, when you go to see the eye doctor in Kaiser Permanente, that eye doctor can also say, oh, gee, Jennifer, you're behind on your colon screening exam. Can I make sure that the fit test is mailed to your house and we can get you up to speed on that? So everyone is part of a team and can see that in a 360 view. And that's a really important part of how we provide care. And it's that platform that became the basis of then having different kinds of clinical decision support tools, which have really allowed our primary care physicians to work to a very high level of service delivery. And I think we see AI in the same kind of way as a further enhancement. But we need to have, to your question and your point, our data organized in a way that can really fuel that. So we're continuing to look at where do we have potential silos in our data that we can organize to make sure that the power of what these tools can offer can really be unleashed to the benefit of our members. So a lot of behind-the-scenes work to get our data organized in that way to make sure that we can fully leverage. And I think it's a critical part. It's probably the most important thing of making sure that we're really ready to take advantage of the revolution that's going to be available through these kinds of tools. So it's an enormous part of it. At the same time that we're building that capacity, we're also trying to build capacity in our workforce to understand how to use these tools and to see them, right? Because if you sort of provide them and then people are like, oh, is this a direct threat to my job versus something that it's over here and I don't need it, then that's not helpful. So we're trying to maintain a good balance between getting ourselves ready to be able to take advantage of these tools through our data, but also training our workforce. That's not just our physicians, but our nurses and other health professionals, how to use these tools to make their jobs easier and more effective and so forth. So I think there's a lot to it. Data is fundamental to driving the value of these tools, but you can't let it get so far ahead of the other parts that people aren't ready to take advantage of those tools either.
And related to that, how far did you at Kaiser anticipate, and you at Andrea at DHSS, anticipate quite significant dislocations in work patterns and jobs? It's quite a risk, isn't it? And to bring along people is crucial.
Well, in terms of how we use these tools, there's always a human in the loop, right? We're still learning so much about them in terms of their accuracy, reliability, some of the things that I touched on earlier about how we're trying to think about responsible use. And, you know, we perceive that there's so much that could still be done to enhance the health of our populations. It's really less about any kind of trying to see our work. It's trying to really help our workforce work to a higher level to find more joy in the work and what they're doing in terms of relieving them from administrative tasks and really helping them work to the top of their license for the benefit of our members. So I really think that has been the focal point of how we're thinking about deploying these tools.
The only thing I would add, we've got just massive workforce shortages in the U.S. And any ways in which this is easing the burden, is making for happier healthcare providers, is seen as a recruitment tool, I think all to the good in the places where we are really struggling to attract and retain health professionals.
Given what you know about the UK NHS, the fact that it can be coordinated, it is centralised, we have got a single data system, what's the advice you'd be giving us now as we go through into the next couple of years facing AI?
I would say a couple things. One, make sure you think about the application of lessons you've learned, whether it's the deployment of electronic health records, whether it's pandemic lessons, all the things that make us smarter about the delivery of care in our communities and the way in which the system works under pressure and doesn't. In the U.S., I think we had so much hope and so much in the basket of the deployment of electronic health records and the initial generations of health IT that has not come to fruition because we built EHRs primarily for healthcare systems and healthcare providers. And we give a lot of lip service to patient access. It's the patient's data. They're driving their care. They're partners in their care. But we haven't really fulfilled that vision. I just would caution all of us not to make the same mistakes twice, not to just think about AI tools as tools for providers and systems for their efficiency, for their work, but how we really think about what we want the healthcare system to look like and demand that the tools help us get there.
So you need to be very strategic and mindful of what you're trying to do and how to use these tools to pursue the goals and values of what your organization is. And what I've always admired about the NHS is it's always been very clear about values of equity and population health and lifting up everyone. And I think being really mindful of that as you look around at the opportunities that these new tools offer to not lose sight of that because of the shiny object or the bells or whistles that come with these different things. And I touched on this earlier, but the degree to which these tools fit into a system of care is so important for them to ultimately be successful in achieving those goals. Having a system to build these tools into to be able to have them give benefit at scale is a tremendous opportunity. I want to see the NHS be successful here because I want to be able to learn what I can bring back to KP and hopefully more broadly to the U.S. But I think there's a tremendous responsibility on the shoulders of the NHS and KP to try to do this and to provide that knowledge as a community benefit so that everyone can benefit from it. And we have a responsibility not to get distracted, but to stay focused in that way.
Well, I don't know about you, but I thought that was really interesting. And the three big things I learned was firstly, the state's role, certainly in regulation, safety, and data privacy. The second big area was how important it is to learn from fast, rapid evaluation done in really good centres, possibly to a rigorous method that's already been agreed and kite marked. I think unless we have this syndicated, federated way of learning, we're going to get left behind. So I think what Andy said about Kaiser being one of those systems and that information being sucked up into a national intelligence radar screen, I think is going to be critical moving forwards. Otherwise, we might have 1,000 flowers blooming and some of the flowers are actually not flowers, they're weeds. And the third area was the interesting potential uses of artificial intelligence to boost population health, not just on the wider determinants, not just on pandemic preparedness and response, but also ongoing support of communities that are trying to build assets to improve health in their communities. And I think that's under-discussed and probably under-invested environment that could be very interesting for the future. So we must leave it there. Many thanks to my guests, Andrea Palm and Andy Beinman, for their insights today. And if you'd like to know more, catch a recording of our AI Summit, at which Andrea and Andy both featured. Please check the show notes to this podcast for the link, or check the Health Foundation's website. Join me next time with Rachel Sylvester, political editor at The Observer, and our very own director of policy, Hugh Alderwick. Meantime, many thanks as ever to Sean and Leo at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and his team at Malt Productions, and goodbye from me until next time, Jennifer Dixon.